Join us as we welcome Alex Castro, the mastermind behind growing his company, the M Corp, from zero to $50 million. He did it in a very unique way. He did it organically. So that's the topic that we will be discussing, how to grow your business organically. You can discover how he overcame the persistent gap between ideas and execution by removing biases and using his groundbreaking readiness score method featured in his book, Measure, Execute, Win, available on Amazon. Let me just flash this to you so that this is the book. Definitely check it out. It's available in all sorts of formats. So today in this episode, Alex will share his unique approach to measuring execution capability and identifying growth opportunities for businesses, as well as tips for fostering a culture of innovation and achieving long-term sustainable growth through organic means. So we're not talking about paid media here. So don't miss out and tune in now. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. So excited to have this conversation with you.
So all of my superhero guests have their back-end story, right? Their backstories. So yeah. Tell me yours and what got you into this, organic growth. And because the thing is, organic growth is challenging at the same time as very rewarding, meaning that you're not piling on a bunch of debt on the company. So Let's get started. Let's get to know you first and then tell us how you got to this journey and that decision of organic growth.
Sure. Prior to starting M Corp, I had done one other startup within the data, digital data industry. And that company I came into a little bit later in the process. And the biggest challenge there is that you had these investors just hovering over you the entire time. And it created such an artificial expectation environment that it was the balancing what the market was ready to absorb versus what the investors wanted to get done. You know, that trying to match all of that while you're trying to build a company, while you're trying to develop the products, while you're trying to evolve operating practices and hire people and all of those different sort of facets within the business, you know, made a very an opportunity or a potential of the company just couldn't keep up with the expectation at times. And I think that limited, the potential. It didn't really expand the potential of the company. And unfortunately, I think that in today's market, there is this perception that a successful company that can go from zero to 10, 50, 100 million or more is something that's a commonplace issue. It's something that can easily be accomplished in 2 to 5 years, and founders walk away with just this treasure trove of wealth and get to move on and do other things. And, I think for those listening in the audience, either those that are doing the organic thing or about to start that, a good company is built over time and it goes through multiple iterations. And there are breaks from that zero to 10, 10 to 20. Things change at each one of those intervals that have to be addressed differently. So I learned quite a bit in that context. And then in founding M Corp, really what, my business partner and I, Chet Chikowski, looked to accomplish was, how do we begin to apply what we do well and really begin to practice that in a very grit-driven, mechanical, consistent way. And so it was, the impetus for it was how do we take what our core capabilities are and begin to apply it in a way that can actually generate some differentiation and some value to customers. And at the end of the day, that's, really the purpose of the company is to create something that is valuable to the customer, to the buyer. And there's a lot I can explore there in terms of,
employees. Yeah, definitely. We'll definitely dig into that. You kind of reminded me of, kind of my journey in the industry that I'm in, right? Mm-hmm. If you remember in the late 90s and 2000, right? Companies got funded, startup ideas got funded, mm-hmm. Anything that had a .com in it, got funded, right?
Yeah.
Or even public companies that changed their name to .com. Nowadays, the same trick as being recycled as blockchain. If it says blockchain on in the public markets, for some reason it just goes up. I don't know why. Yeah. There's nothing.
And AI.
Yeah, and AI now. Now, actually, yes. When we're recording this right now in 2023, AI is the big buzzword. Machine learning and AI is gigantic. Yes. ChatGPT and so on.
Yep.
But it reminded me, like, on the other side of it, when you have capital on you, cash on you, meaning mm-hmm. that either venture capital gave you money or somehow you raised your money from friends and family, there's right. always somebody who needs to take that money from you. So in case of late 90s and 2000, that company at that time, it was not Google. At that time, it was AOL, if you remember.
Yes.
You would give all of your money to AOL. That was the yes. thing to do, right?
Yes.
And then yep. the other place that you will give your money would be, sock puppet on Super Bowl commercial. I mean, yes. Super Bowl, by the way, is a highly valuable real estate. Definitely, I would recommend oh, yeah. that for the right reasons,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But then you fast forward it to this next iteration that came around 2008 and 9, anything that said social media or, mm-hmm. Anything that said social media, boom, money started pouring in. Again,
right.
the formula changed. Now you would give your money to, at that time, you would give your money to Yahoo and yeah. Google. Those were the yes. two platforms.
Yes.
And you yes. still, Super Bowl was still in the picture. Right.
Right.
They'll take your money yeah. and they were burning through a lot of money. Right. And in, yeah. in the 2010 all the way through now. Right. It's more of that. Right. I mean, when I see one of the reasons I actually launched this channel was because any YouTube channel that you go to that preaches Shopify or Amazon or whatever, it's usually Shopify plus Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And when they say Facebook, it's not about content marketing, which is organic. It's yes. about giving money to Facebook ads, but you may not be even ready as a company to do that, right? So right. I totally, I'm with you, brother.
Yeah. Companies well, and this
need
year.
To do the slow and steady, they need to do the smart thing. And we will yeah. talk about all of those things,
Yeah. Well, your market is like a sponge, right? There are points that it hits saturation. There are points that it has an absorption of what it is that you're offering, that it's able to keep up with the pace at what you're offering, and or it's ready to absorb more than you can offer. I think that, the biggest challenge in 23 for a lot of companies is going to be the diversification of a lot of what you spoke to, more moving towards virtualization. So Web 3.0 or Web 3, blockchain, as you mentioned, is going to start to play a major role. And those two elements are then going to begin to really drive more investment into the metaverse, right? And the really monetization of cognitive computing, right? So how is all of this AI, machine learning, intelligent automation, how is all that going to begin to, affect the ability to really promote within the context that you spoke to? Because in the Web3 world, in the virtual world, that is all disconnected. Facebook, doesn't necessarily have that umbrella component to it. And now you're dealing with sort of microclimates of interaction, which is more centered around the user rather than, the provider or the gateway. And so as a result, there's going to be a lot of, I think, changes in those spaces, especially as we move into, heavier investments into NFTs and any kind of token-based exchanges. Last year alone, I think in 22, the number was about $1 billion worth of investment into the metaverse. And that's supposed to triple this year. So that combination is going to begin to restructure how, how business is done within that context. And it's a lot of what we are doing, because historically, as a company, we built out as really a company that helped customers gather data and clean up data. We do a lot of work in intelligent automation right now with bots and robotic automation. And, the biggest challenge, I think, with AI, everybody, kind of looks at AI as, ChatGPT right now has really socialized AI in a way that can be, the average person can connect to it. Like they actually get it. Like they can do something with
it. And we thought that voice assistants like Siri and and Alexa and you know, Google Home would be the answer there. But it had its shortcoming, meaning that it was very transactional. It was not conversational when you Correct. Interacted with those devices.
Right. I mean, you know, you can put in, you know, I'll be fully transparent. You know, I do this quarterly fireside chat with our employees. We're about 350 people, you know, nationally. And I put in, you know, I write a letter out to employees prior to this so that they can kind of, you know what's coming and prepare some questions and, you know, and those kinds of things. And I actually put my letter into ChatGPT and I said, make this better. And it responded back with a really great edit around it. And so I think that, you know, right now that sort of socialization of AI is now going to put this into the mainstream and people are going to be like, okay, well, why can't we integrate ChatGPT into Siri or Alexa? And I want to be able to interact with, you know, now the pace is going to go faster in that direction. And at the root of it, you know, AI works from a basis of why. Right. The most misunderstood part of AI is that you have to ask the question, why? Why is my customer base working this way? Why is the market moving this way? Why is fill in the blank? And at the root of that is data. And the problem today is that better than half data stores that anybody has, you know, pick a company, doesn't matter scale, is really not good. And it's been because it's mostly human driven. I mean, think about when you go to a doctor's office or the dentist and you have to fill out the form. You're like, oh, for God's sakes, you know, I got to fill out this form. Half of the stuff is ineligible. You only complete what you want to complete because you don't, A, want to share information, or B, just don't see a point and don't want to do it, or you put in misinformation for whatever reason. And that compounding effect is then what affects the ability for AI to do its job. So there's still some root things. And that's, as a company, that's how we've, you know, kind of progressed and moved in this direction. You know, when we started, it was a lot about how do you collect higher quality data so that you can respond to the customer based on their need. And now it's evolving into, well, we've got, you know, this massive data store and the data is corrupt or it's incomplete. And, you know, we deal with this from, you know, healthcare data. We deal with it, you know, we do a lot of COVID data across the country. You know, we've been doing that for the last couple of years and helping populate, you know, digital vaccine records so people can be at the airport and say, oh gosh, I need my digital vaccine record and I need to promote it. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that definitely impact.
I mean, there from that perspective, I think that what I've seen in my kind of my lifetime is kind of evolution of data, right? Mm-hmm. It used to live in like printed books, right? Accounting records and general ledgers and stuff like that. People write it down in a book, right? Yep. And then it started getting transformed into getting it typewritten or green bar, right? Then it moved to computers now can store it for you so that I can pull it up in a raw data, Excel spreadsheets and stuff like that, or Quattro Pro and Lotus 1-2-3. Sure. Yeah. I'm showing my age, by the way. I'm not as young as I look, by the way.
Quattro Pro, yeah.
I don't look as young as I look. I just celebrated my 50th birthday.
Oh, you know? Happy birthday.
Thank you. So, but then time came when you put the human element of data scientists into the mix, like human element, right?
Yeah.
Now I'm collecting all this data. What insights can I get from it in order to educate? There were some simpler systems that looked at and did forecasting, inventory forecasting and things of that nature, but they were more like automation rather than deeper insights like machine learning or AI. I think now we are getting into this phase, this in 2023 now, or the 2020s, that now it's like it's more AI driven. Like you said, the example you used was your letter to your employees, right?
Yeah.
You can take that letter if you have the gist of it in there, and then you ask ChatGPT to say that, make it empathetic and make sure that it's highly engaging, that it's rewarding to be part of this and whatever. You give it more context even as an AI prompt engineering is a real thing now, right?
Yep.
If you engineer that and it comes back to you, you go like, oh my God, this is incredible. This is, I think that ChatGPT very naturally for a lot of people, it should go into an email. You should, after you write it, you press a button, say,
Right.
You know, because some people, they're not empathetic. When somebody says, oh, I'm not feeling well, I can't come to work today because, or my wife is going into labor. And that next response coming out of your face, writing it down, could be not empathetic.
Right.
That person, you may just turn them off.
Yes.
That happened to me in my career, by the way. A VP of marketing, you know, very senior to me and very early in my career. It was my religious holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, it's the worst day you could have taken off. Are you serious?
Yeah.
This is my religious holiday. I don't care for you today. You know,
mm-hmm.
Work is not that important to me right now. You know,
right.
So that kind of a thing, I think, could go through that filter first to kind of humanize it a bit before it gets sent to the masses or to even it's a one-on-one interaction with people.
Yeah. So bouncing back to, you know, sort of your original premise, you know, in growing the company, you know, we started out in this sort of consultative way. Well, actually, we started as a software as a service company in 2003. And we tried to promote this. And before there was really significant internet, before there was significant, you know, cloud, there was no cloud for that matter. And I think that we were ahead of the curve and we had to readjust to what the market was willing to buy from us. And so we evolved that process organically. And, you know, to be quite honest, we didn't ever actually consider taking on capital. Although once you start a company, you just start getting bombarded by people saying, hey, you know, I can raise some capital for you, or I can get you this loan, or I can get you those things. And we were just so simply in a state that it's like, you know, why do you want to take that risk when you're in a sort of trying to prove out the concept, right? Because there's a consequence to the back end. If you do not perform within the context of what you want to do, people don't just give you money and then say, oh, it didn't work out, sorry, I'm going to walk away. They oftentimes kind of take some, you know, some of you with them. And so there's a balancing act in there. But I think that organically, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs. There are times that we definitely struggled financially to grow. You know, one of the biggest limitations in growth is, you know, is capital, right? So how can you best leverage capital in moving forward? And I think that, you know, really, you know, there were times where we were flush. Like we were doing extremely well. Customers were really buying a lot from us. And now you have the disconnect in the sense that you've got two founders who know how to go from 0 to 5, 0 to 10 very comfortably. Like I am very comfortable living in a, we have no revenue and we've got to go figure out how to get that revenue. I'm okay in that space. You put me in a space where you're 20 million plus and I start to lose my own value in that context, right? My value, like in as a CEO, the biggest thing I'm dealing with in the last couple of quarters is I'm having to redefine my job description, because in bringing in a team of very experienced, very qualified, very capable people to start to really run and grow the company, you have to learn how to, you know, you have to learn how to step aside in many ways. And so as an example, you know, with my business partner, what I often tell him is like, look, you know, we have this Tesla, right? And we just put it in self-driving mode. You have to let go of the steering wheel. Like you can't have it in self-driving mode and try to steer it at the same time. It's just, you're just fighting the organization and then, you know, in that context. And so in redefining our roles as founders, as co-founders and leaders within the context, you know, what I started promoting a couple of years ago in preparation for this was, you know, we want to be founder inspired, not founder led, right? There is a time that as a founder, as an originator, you have to stop being founder-led. There are things that you contribute in the vision and the direction that are perpetual. But the thing that from a, you know, touching everything that goes on just doesn't work out. And so there's a transition point that you have to recognize in there.
So while you were describing that, you know, two things were coming to my mind, and I wanted to use a specific example. And I'm sure that you're a fan of this movie collection also, right? So I'm going to use movies, right?
Yeah, I love it.
To me, when I, you know, it's movies that are like slow burn, versus action movies, right?
Yep.
So within the same franchise, Godfather 1, slow burn, you really get immersed in the story. Godfather 3, you don't care for it, right?
I can't react to that because that's gonna, that's like a male bastion of sensitivity in there somehow.
I know, but I'm trying to describe that. Like, but it has been around for now what, about 70 years now, right? It's been around for a long time. Yeah. Right? That movie, it was out in 1970s, I think, Godfather 1.
So yeah, it's about 50 years. Yeah.
About 50 years, as old as I am, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, the fans are so much hardcore on the Godfather 1, but when it comes to 2 and 3, they don't care for it. They go like, well, they messed up the franchise, right? So I think when it comes to, I know that there are two different schools there, but my point is that when it comes to like organic growth, it's like you're growing as a human being in that organization as a founder, including your startup team that's with you.
Yeah.
Right. Some of them will be with you for a long time. Some of them may fall out because, like you said, like 0 to 5, 0 to 10, not a problem. When it goes from 20 million to 50, you go like, oh my God, what do I do now? You know?
Yeah. Well, 20 is the big break in many ways, because what happens at 20 million is that up to 20 million, you have a culture where everybody's all hands on deck. You know, everybody's covering each other. People are doing things outside of their core job role to help in doing a lot of those things. At 20, you need to begin to create more structure and discipline. And as you get into the 30 million range, you really need systems that help manage the organization. Netflix has a book about how they founded and ran and developed Netflix, which is exceptional. So as a viewer, I would really recommend that. And really what happens is that as you do these expansions and contractions, especially on the contractual, certain contraction periods, because you're going to have them. There is no up and to the right in perpetuity. You know, a lot of that stuff is, there are very, very few companies, less than 5% of companies that really have the perpetual up and to the right. You have to always pull back.
Yeah, always have to pull back.
Well, the market tells you to pull back, right? Yeah. Because you have to be, it's you're in synchronicity or asynchronicity to the market demand or what it is. You know, you lose sort of that cachet sometimes. You're out there, you're the hot topic, and then all of a sudden you're the old topic. And then you have to reinvent yourself and move to the next step.
AI presentation, Alex. You do an AI presentation in front of the world, and you did a live presentation and you should not have.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you do that 20 to 30 million and suddenly you need to put in systems like performance management systems, right? And, we've dealt with this, and suddenly you put in a performance management systems into a group of people that potentially have never, especially, either people who have been more in the small business space, entrepreneurial space, or just younger people within the business. The next thing you know, you have this very, very stiff pushback that says, I don't want to, why are you measuring me? What is this all about? And people start to retract and clamp down. And you have to make sure that performance management objective is more about, no, I'm trying to help you be a better professional. This is my contribution to you. And then how well are you aligned in the work that you're doing against our strategy and how we're moving forward? And so it's a feedback loop, right? But people have such fear around performance management, especially if you're in the entrepreneurial space, right? I mean, I do what I do because I started working at 13 years old, right? And I worked for a Russian butcher for a couple of years. And I worked in a steakhouse as a busboy. And I worked in a pizza place in a mall. And like, I learned through the years up through banks and whatever that it's like, I really am not necessarily suited to work for someone else. You know, it's just, it was one of those things. Plus, having immigrant parents, it's like I kind of always had a chip on my shoulder because immigrant parents are tend to be very conservative. It's like, well, what are you doing? Why aren't you a doctor? You know,
doctor, lawyer, engineer.
Exactly. You know, why aren't you stable? You need to do, and it's like, no, this is my path. And so as you go into that space in performance management, as an example, in that transformation of the business, you know, that is, it's, you're going to have attrition and you're going to have people who are like, yeah, why? And they're going to push back hard. Now you're spending all this time and doing it, but you need those systems. You need those systems and processes in a way that doesn't limit innovation or creativity, does not limit, because we always have to remember high performing people don't want to be over process managed. They want to have freedom to explore. They are innovative and curious people by nature, and you want to retain them. And if you overprocess, if you start ratcheting down and saying, no, this is the system, you have to follow those people will flock out the door. And what you're left with is sort of like the mid-range to low-range performers, and you will struggle to pull people in. We're seeing that right now in the evacuation of large entities of high-talent people. They're abandoning those large entities because it's like, I just can't deal with the overprocess component, right? There's just too much. And I want to go back to really being able to have a touch influence on everything I do. And so it's in leading that, you have to balance it. In leading it, you have to adjust from, you know, up to 20. Now you need to have clear roles. Then at 20, 30, you need to start to see a lot more systems and processes. And as a leader, you have to maintain the vision and the culture as a CEO and make sure that the values and the culture of the business are maintained while you're maturing the way you do things and interact with each other. So there's a lot of adaptation that goes on. The benefit we have is I don't have debt. I do not have investors who are like, I don't care about any of that. What's your growth rate? Right? What are you doing? You know, in
when am I going to get a return on my investment?
Right. Or we're shooting for this target. Let's say that, you know, we're in 23. So, well, by the end of 24 or end of 25, we want to be in a position to either go public or sell or something. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or take on another round so I can get my money back and, you know, whatever it may be. And, you know, we were just talking a little bit ago about the whole virtualization and AI space. That is going to evolve on its own pace. And you have to be able to adapt to that. And if you have this like artificial pressure coming at you, regardless of whether it's debt, like a bank saying, you know, hey, you need to start your payments on the loan, right? Or you have investors who are saying, yeah, no, no, you should be here and we need to go. There is... that chaos can start to really interfere with the vision and the progress of the company. And we found that having that flexibility and not having that oppressive kind of, at times, it's not always bad, sort of that oppressive artificial direction has allowed us to really explore ourselves as a company and then grow. I mean, we are in our 20th year of business right now. And you know, I shared with our employees in my CEO letter that it's, you know, going from zero, like nothing, like having to, you know, find a customer, limping along on a monthly basis, trying to meet the obligations of your family, paying the mortgage, taking care of your family, those kinds
payroll.
Of things. Payroll, whatever, you know, I mean, there's, you know, going from that state to where we are today has been, you know, you're somewhat numb when you get to that space. Like you're so, it's like being slapped over and over again. After a while, you just don't feel it anymore. And suddenly you get to this place and you're having to try to stop and really be present and mindful of where you are and be like, you know, let's run an inventory here because reaching this place was a lift and we're here and we have nobody who's dominating us. So, And it takes time. You know, again, I can't emphasize enough, there are very, very few companies that go from zero to 100 organically within 2, 3, 4 years. And if you're doing it artificially, the thing you have to remember is that you're going to have this much of the pie when you get there, because the amount of money that needed to be invested, those investors are going to take the lion's share of the value of that company. And so when it reaches that sort of that point, regardless of what the number is, your part of it is this, right? And I'll share a quick story if that's okay. It's like,
Actually, what I want to do, Alex, is unpack, because you said a lot of things in there.
Okay.
A few things in there. Culture fit. And I want to talk about, I'm sure that given your 20 years, you've had folks that went through the company and either they established themselves and they're high performers and they're doing great.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not a culture fit. Either you recognized it or they recognized it for themselves. And one of the culture, when it doesn't fit, is let's say if I am I'm a performance minded, high performance minded, that means that I want Alex to give me that budget so that I can go and give it to Facebook and Google so that I can do my thing, right?
Oh yeah,
because I can. He has brought it to 50 million. I can bring it to 250 million. He's stopping me from doing all these things, right? That kind of a mindset.
Right.
Versus people who really understand your rhythm and they understand, like, you know what? I would rather like have 50 clients that are going to be with us for the next 10 years, right? So that we can continue growing with them. We will grow, they will grow, and that's going to be a mutual relationship versus like crash and burn and go through a lot of capital. So do you have any of those kind of war stories? Because you did talk about high performers in there.
Yeah.
High performers through your company, they would have issues, you know.
Very much. You know, we've had a few rounds of that. Early on, we would bring people in expressly who had a lot of proven history, proven
nice resumes.
Yeah. And really added immediate value, right? So they come in, they've been through the meat grinder a bit, they understand how to get things done. And you bring them in because you're trying to grow this business, you're trying to deliver results for customers, you're trying to build the brand, you're trying to figure out your story and your messaging, you're trying to do sales and development, you're trying to do all of these things all at the same time. Right. So you're running the gamut from every part of the company, right? And dealing with the accounting and dealing with all of the, you know, the regulatory issues that you deal with and dealing with the government. And what winds up happening is that you bring in these people because they're more senior, you don't have to manage them as much, right? It's like, hey, I'm going to put you on this client. Here's your team. Take care of the client. And you're just sort of like, okay, I know this person's going to take care of them. The biggest challenge that happens is a couple of different things. One is, and we fell into this trap. One is that the tail starts to wag the dog at some point, right? So you have this vision for what you want to do, but your customer facing people, your operations people are like, no, we don't have capacity for that. You can't do that. We don't do that. We can't go there. They want to live in their very, not comfortable, but they want to live in that zone of expertise and in that, you know, it's like they don't want to be overwhelmed or they're not comfortable being overwhelmed. And so suddenly you've been the pilot on, or you bring in management that can help and start to push that. And suddenly they're like, I'm out because I don't want to be managed. Like they don't want to be subordinated to somebody else. They're no longer reporting to a founder. Now they're reporting to somebody between the founder and them.
And I was here for 5-10 years. Why, Alex? Why did you do this to me?
Right. Yep. It's like, hey, that's not good. Why am I not doing that? And it's like, well, because your skill set is not managing people, right? I mean, there's always this constant reference that, you know, just because you're good at what you do means that you can lead a group. It's leadership and doing are very two different things. And there's very few people who can do and lead as effectively as they do either. And sometimes a leader, they don't have, they could, if you put them on a project or you put them on a client, you know, to do something, you know, they're going to be okay, but they're amazing as a leader. They can coordinate, they understand how to manage people, they can motivate, they can communicate. And so there's a lot of that goes on. And that issue of churn can be very frustrating. But also, you know, what also happens at times, and, you know, again, I have felt this personally, is, and I say this, like, whenever I get a question from somebody who's younger, you know, starting out, you know, one of the things that they ask me is like, well, what's the number one thing I've got to watch out for? it's like you're going to be betrayed. In some way, you're going to be betrayed because you're going to have this person, you're going to pour yourself into them, you're going to give them every opportunity to succeed, you're going to, you know, you're going to invest yourself in the company and this person to help grow the company. And suddenly a person's going to turn around and say, oh, I got this great offer from a competitor and I'm going to go work for them. Thanks for everything. And you're going to be very hurt by that.
Then you realize, Alex, love is a one-way street.
At times. And you know, it's happened to me probably a handful of times, and it still bugs me. And it's simply the truth of leading a business. It's the truth of doing that. And you can't get cold. Like, you know, the thing that I continuously emphasize to our leadership and to our staff is lead with empathy. Always lead with empathy. Because at the end of the day, you have to be able to connect to not only your team, but you also have to connect to the customer. And if you get into this cold, hard attitude, that'll serve you for a little while, but it will wind up alienating you in the end. And you have to lead with empathy. You have to connect with the people within the context. And that's very hard for hard driving, you know, performers when you bring them in, because they're like, no, we've got to go here. We've got to do this. And this is what we're going to do. And they tend to want to steamroll. And you're like, it's like, you know, let's introduce that next level of, you know, emotional maturity into your leadership style, which is leading with empathy rather than with brusqueness.
You know, the thing is, when you have a startup and people are part of that story right from the beginning, setting those expectations as early on as possible is important, because it's possible that the person joined you when they were out of college, right?
Yeah.
But you threw everything at them. They had the inspiration, aspiration, everything to just consume it and do. They just kept on doing, and you were happy with them doing it. However, the thing is, they're just learning everything on the go, but they don't really have the context of other different case studies or challenges or overcoming those kind of challenges as you're growing. They don't have it. They just have the context of whatever they are in. But finding those people, they are golden gems. But you have to, just as much as they deliver to you as a leader, I think you need to, whether in the beginning it's the founder, basically.
Yeah.
That founder needs to set expectations and talk about where the journey is and where we are going and how we need to bring other people in, just to kind of, you know, condition the people more and more to, so that they're part of that journey, not that they're surprised next morning they wake up, they were running marketing, and next morning they have now a VP of marketing above them.
Yeah.
They feel like that communication wasn't there. That relationship wasn't there. They go like, well, things were promised to me, you know?
Right.
And you never have promised anything to anybody, you know?
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. It's very much, it's something that gets done very much, and you hear very much, and, you know, it's almost heartbreaking at times, but it's funny, you know, Simon Sinek has, you know, this talk that he gives where he has, you know, it's a millennial, or I shouldn't say that because it's too blanket. He has a younger professional involved in the conversation, and that individual comes to the boss and says, hey, look, I'm doing just as much as everybody else right now. I should be compensated the same way. I should have the same authority. I should be doing the same things. And the boss is to the effect saying, yeah, I hear you. And you're doing it in calm waters. Like, I know that this team around you, they've been in rough seas. And they can hoist a sail in rough seas. I've never seen you do that. So when things get tough, I don't know if you're going to show up. And that's the thing that I think is hard for an employee, you know, in that context, or somebody who's joined your journey in that organization, is that it's like, yeah, I see the work and I value the work. We haven't hit all of the different parts of the road that are going to demand from you until I can see you work through that. And I think it's one of the, generationally, I think it's one of the toughest things right now, is that it's acceptable to be at a job for 2 years and leave, or a year and a half and leave and bounce every year and a half. And people think, oh, I'm just going to make more money. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to, oh, this is more interesting over here. I'm going to go do that thing over there. The challenge with that is that you never develop a core competency, and nobody's ever seen you through the tough times, because when everything, you know, anything gets uncomfortable for you, you bounce and you're out. And so now you have this conundrum as a leader. How do I hire in talent and know that that talent's going to stick with me as I get into some tough parts. Because again, it's not all smooth sailing. And suddenly, let's say you have investors or you have somebody else come in or new leadership come in and they're starting to put pressure on those people. And those people, oh, wow, this is too much pressure. I'm going to go. And suddenly it's like, hey, look, we've been investing in you to grow. Now things are getting tough and you're just uncomfortable and you want to go away. And so that's, I think, one of the struggles right now in that hiring curve. It's like, how do you actually develop and mature talent that's going to stick with you? And I'm not offering that somebody should stay with a company regardless, or that they should be there for 10, 20 years. What I'm offering is that it's seeing it through the commitment, right? And and it's about, you know, it gets down to the bottom line of grit. Like, do you have the ability to work through it, right? I define grit in the context of it's unrelenting persistence in the face of failure. Like, it's like, that failed. Get up, go again. Get up, go again. Go again, go again, go again. Just hammer and grind. And I think that's one of the hardest parts of being an entrepreneur and starting a business, is regardless of whether you have funding or not. You know, product development usually takes more funding than services. But, you know, it's, you have to be able to understand that you will fail, and you will fail a lot. And it's how you show up after that failure, because it's an inevitability within the context of what you do. Like, nothing is pure. There is no pureness in that. So,
you know, one of the things that I say is, like, either you succeed in entrepreneurship, right? When you're growing a business, either you succeed, or if you're wise, you're learning from those things that didn't work. Those were trials. So sometimes you're going to try it 50 times. It's not going to work, you know? And then the 51st time it worked. Maybe, you know, it's like in case of a services company, the type of companies you were going after, the revenue that you were going after, however you segmented them, was the wrong segment. It doesn't mean that your service or product was wrong. It's just that you were talking to the wrong people. You know, you were in the wrong forest, cutting down wrong trees, you know.
Absolutely.
And expecting it to work because you're a brilliant scientist and it should work, you know? No. You were just talking to the wrong people. You shift it, and all of a sudden you have, well, even if it's a product, maybe it's a product that you're promoting. It's meant to be for seniors, and you're running your ads on TikTok. And, you know, you're on the wrong platform altogether.
Right.
You have to have that better understanding, or have a culture of testing and learning and optimizing. And then if some things don't work, abandon, because there are 1,000 other ideas you could be trying. Don't waste your time on ego, you know, thinking that it's your idea. Yeah. It should work.
Right. Right. And tuning it. I mean, look, we've probably gone through, you know, more, probably 8 to 10 different product ideas that we've launched and pushed and tried to cajole. And some of the stuff that we offered was just way too early. Like, how we started the company was almost like a cloud service for certain data collection pieces. And people at the time were just like, whoa, 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 I'm not in control. And this isn't in my data center or whatever it may be. And I was just like, yeah, why do you want to own this? Like, this is, you know, it's just overhead. Like, just rent the app, let it run and collect the data. You get the, at the end of the day, all you want is the data, and we're going to ensure that it's good data. Why do you want to own the infrastructure? And they were so more focused on the infrastructure of it and owning the infrastructure, regardless of the output of the system. And you're just sitting there trying to re-communicate it. It's like, it's almost like when somebody asks you, well, can you define this word? And you use that word in the definition. And it's like, no, no, it's like this circular argument. And you're just sitting there with the customer saying, but why do you want to own the infrastructure? It's just going to weigh you down. Just get the data it produces, and you're like, it's no more sweat for you. And they're just stuck on that. And you're trying to move a market in doing that. And you get to these places where you're just so obstinate that this is the way it has to be. And the market's like, yeah, no thanks. And you have to adapt. You have to pivot. You have to say, look.
Because you don't know, Alex, you don't know if the guy you're talking to, their nephew, runs the hardware infrastructure.
Exactly.
And all they're hearing is they're not hearing the benefits of cloud-based solutions and stuff like that. They're hearing their nephew is going to be out of a job because all that data
center, or their own authority, is going to get reduced.
It's going to be great cost savings and stuff moving it over to cloud and so on. But they're hearing my nephew is going to be out of a job.
Right. And, you know, we've run into a lot of those. And you have to be able to let it go. You have to be able to pivot. You have to be able to adapt. I mean, as a company, we started out as, in essence, an execution-centered data gathering company. And we've been very successful in that space for many, many entities across, you know, the US. We've done work in Australia and in Europe. And, you know, we've had great, great success. You know, the one thing that we pride ourselves on is that we've never been fired by a customer ever. In 20 years, we've never gotten the pink slip from a customer. And that means a lot to us. It has no value in marketing. I'll tell you that right now. Because I had a senior leader tell me about 10 years ago, she was just really great. And she came to me and she's like, Alex, it's like, I appreciate the fact you guys have never failed, you know, as a provider. No one has ever failed. Like as a company, no one, like if you think of the big four consulting firms, if you think of the top 10, you know, product companies, no one is ever going to say, well, we failed that. Right. So your words have no meaning, right? Even though it's true.
One of the things as a client, I would ask you if you're pitching me, I'll say that when does it, the M Corp does not work? Can you give me an example? And if you don't have a response, I think that you're lying or trying to hide something from me. Not that the answer is, well,
most people aren't smart enough to ask that question though. And so you have to, you know, you have to just be adaptive in that context. And so now the story is different. The story about what you're doing is different. And the product has to evolve. And the way you go to market and your go-to-market motion and your go-to-market velocity has to change. Because you can't walk around, you know, clubbing people in the head. You know, I worked with a guy who was also in the data business. You know, I did a stint at Transamerica and he was an acquisition that came in. And, you know, he was so frustrated at times with the way that customers would react to content or lack of content. And, you know, he would always say, it's about the data, stupid. It's just about the data. And he's like, we need to go and we need to hit these people in the back of the head with a 2x4 metaphorically and get them to understand this. And it's like, yeah, they're not going to get it. You know, and this is in, you know, basically the late 90s, early 2000s. And it's like, yeah, I agree with you 100%, but the market is not thinking that way. And that's where, again, we go back to the original premise is that if you have funding, that funding is an artificial velocity against what is the market ready to buy and listen to, right? Because AI has been talked about for 10 years or more. You know, there's all of this concern around it, which has some legitimacy to it, right? Depending on what side of it you fall.
I'm a computer science graduate from 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I took classes in my college. Neural networks, artificial intelligence, machine learning, 30 years ago. Right. Yeah. So it was always there. And I'm sure that it was there before me, right? Yeah. Before I took that class.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the 2000, you know, in around 2001, I was working in neural networks on a product that in essence automated the valuation of your home. So, you know, for those who are a little bit older in the spectrum, you know, when that first came out that you could actually type your address into the internet and get sort of an estimated value, you know, I was one of those folks in the background who was, you know, leading that effort. It's been around for a long time. And I think that, you know, realistically right now it's learning how is the market going to adapt and integrate that? Because I think with the adoption of AI, with the augmented reality glasses that are coming out right now, like we're experimenting right now with how do we send a prospect or a customer a set of AR glasses, you know, a headset.
Oculus or something.
Yeah. And, or, you know, I think, you know, Microsoft has got
the cardboard.
And we do a presentation to them in an AR world, meaning that there's transparency in the lens, like they can see this, but also that it projects, you know, a menu or it projects some content and you can actually shape and play with it. And is that going to be something we launch next month? I doubt it. Is it going to be something we launch this year? I'd say there's a better than 50-50 shot that we're going to do that. In 24, are we going to probably launch it? Yeah, I would say there's a pretty high probability, because as this progresses, right? So now it's an adaption or an adoption to what's happening. And, again, one of the things I stated in my CEO letter is that the only thing that doesn't change is that everything changes. Change is the one thing that doesn't change, right? It's like you will always have change. Everything else is variable. And that's hard. It's hard for people. It's hard, especially coming out of a pandemic. It's hard being in this sort of recessionary threat right now. There's, all kinds of behaviors that are happening and instabilities. And people at the end of the day, again, this is why I say you have to lead with empathy, because people do a job and they get connected to a job. And sometimes that job is a career and they are very passionate about that work. And they go home and they go for hikes and they go, hang out with their kids,
families,
or their partner, or, or sit and play video games all day. It doesn't matter. Like, this person is not in the perpetuity of doing the work. The work, right. They may have passion around the work, but there is a balance in there. And so you have to recognize that, the ability to adapt and change while you want that. There are certain people who thrive on that, in the distribution of the bell curve. The bell curve is like, it's progressive change and you have to match it. And that's where you have those ups and downs with your companies, because are you in or out of sync with that adoption and that change component? Because there's, to your point, there's been people who have been pressing AI and machine learning and cognitive computing, neural networks in some context for 25 years. ChatGPT comes out and suddenly it's all the rage. 6 months prior to that, Alexa's dumb. So you went from Alexa's dumb to it's the new thing. And so it's how do you pivot and adapt to that component? And I think that's, as a leader, the thing that you need to be able to do.
Given your journey with organic growth, I'm sure that there are plenty of misconceptions about organic growth. If you were sitting in a mastermind with kind of your equals, but they're all doing performance marketing, right?
Yeah.
And they're doing all fueling it through capital infusion and stuff like that. What are some of those people in that room telling you that are complete misconceptions? And which ones are your favorites?
Oh, wow. That was a wonderful question. I think that you're going to have guidance from people who are just simply conservative, right? In the sense of, don't go out too far. Don't take too many risks. Don't take out, this, that, or the other. To people who are like, no, you've got to go and get $5 million in funding and spend $4.9 million of that in marketing, right?
And you're going to 6.5.
Yeah, right. You got a $5 million infusion. You need to spend an additional $1.5 million.
Leverage it and spend $10 million.
Right. And so I think that, everybody is full of advice in a lot of different things. You have to do some analysis around what you're doing. At the end of the day, if you are a leader of a business and you are an entrepreneur by nature, what you are in is a risk environment, and you have to be comfortable in that risk environment. And more importantly, you have to be able to take a few minutes here and there to really run an inventory of, where am I? What's happening? What do I need to adapt to? And so, I've gone to talks where somebody says, if you have a well-functioning company, you should be able to take off 1 week a day, one day a week, 1 week a month, and 1 month a year. Like, that's what you should be shooting for. And I'm like, I have no idea how to connect to anything that person just said, right? Because what they're trying to promote is that if you have a business that you are having to touch every day and run every day, you don't have a business. You just have this thing that you continuously have to produce energy for and keep moving on, which has some truth to it. But there is a time that takes to get to that place where the business runs itself. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. And
so I think not, Alex, a baby does not come out and start running and
exactly.
running to college on, you know, when they're 2 months old.
Yeah.
They will poop, they will vomit, you know, they will have cold.
I have daughters in their 20s.
You have to baby it.
And I'm still, yeah, and I'm still coaching and mentoring. It, you know, my role has changed, yet I'm still, you know, providing some of that back. And so it's a great question. And I wish I could just point to something and be much more succinct around it. I think that what the thing that I offer, you know, in this kind of conversation the most is that it is not a simple road. It is not, oh, I'm just going to get this funding. I'm still going to own, you know, more than half the company. I'm going to make all the decisions. All the decisions are going to be right. People are going to just do what I say. And yet they're all going to still function independently. None of that works. And it is a grind. It is a hard lift. It is a continuous grind. There are many people that you know, that I know, who are in it for 10, 15, 25 years, and they are still grinding. I still grind. My job is different in how I grind, but I am still grinding every day to continue to move the agenda forward, because it can slip backwards so fast. And now retrenching and getting back to where you were before is sometimes feels like twice the effort, and so on and so on. And so it's an ebb and flow. And it is not a simple journey. People love, it's like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm doing, it's like, And I can always tell.
Not a glamorous job.
Tell the ones who haven't been through the struggle, because they're like, oh yeah, we're, you know, it's all like this and it's all like that. And I'm like, And it will take a toll on you, you know? And it's
like,
the one thing.
It's like that, Alex, single people talking about married life.
Exactly. You know, I will. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you can always tell the person who's never been married. You can always tell the person who really hasn't, you know, been an entrepreneur. And it's, you know, the one thing I'll offer you is this is, you know, as another insight, is that we've hired a lot of people, and especially recently, who have come out of large companies, like multi-billion dollar, high performing, I won't say the brands, but very, very, very respected brands with globally. And even they have to adjust to the rhythm of an entrepreneurial model, because they don't have the weight of that brand behind them, right? So if you combine the weight, yeah, if you have the weight of a brand, the infrastructure, your processes that are well-heeled and established, plus the raw talent that they have as tremendously skilled, talented people, you put those three things together and they can move an agenda at times. And they leave because they're frustrated because of the overhead in the process. And we've seen more and more of it. They want to come into our environment. They're like, I want to be more contactful. I want to really be on leading this thing. I don't want this, like, investment, you know, a board or whatever on top of me. It's like, I get it, right? Let's go. And it takes me a good minimum of 6 months to deprogram them from that world to my world, you know? And, yeah. And, you know, and we're doing, you know, we've got a very healthy revenue stream. We've got wonderful, wonderful clients, and we are very fortunate and grateful for those clients. And we will do everything we can to make them the most successful that they can be, or they ask us to be, help them be. But
I mean, in that deprogramming, I think it's a lot of old habits and a lot of bad habits.
Yeah.
That don't work in your context, in your world, right?
Exactly.
You have to, like, cleanse them off of that, like have a cleansing ritual, maybe even water. and I don't know, rosemary, burning some rosemary or something like that.
Yeah.
Because all that juju needs to leave them and leave their body. Because it takes the thing is, they have been conditioned to act in a certain way. And they assume that even though they hated that thing over there, That's why they left. But they, when they come in, go like, "Oh, when I was XYZ, insert
I can't even begin to tell you, how many times I've gotten that. It's like, well, when I was with such and such, and they had this, and they had that. It's like, yeah, well, you're not there anymore, and you're not there anymore because you didn't want to be there anymore.
Tell me what you think. Just tell me what you think. Don't tell me that aspect of it because you hated it. That's why you left.
And you know, for me, the phrase that I always get fairly triggered around is when somebody says to me, well, this is best practices.
For whom?
I'm like, well, it's best practices. Whenever somebody says best practices to you, it's best practices for the S&P 100 and above. Like from one S&P number one to number 100, they can afford that best practice because they just throw money and muscle at it. And they will push that meat through the pipe. Like they will jam it through. They will make it work, right? For the rest of us, we cannot afford the best practice. So you have to take the parts and pieces that you can apply and integrate them into what you're doing. But whenever I hear a client say, well, we were told that these best practices, it's like, okay, that best practice, right? So, you know, we were talking with a client, they're like, well, we were told the best practices for this AI thing is this, 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 and this, right? And helping them develop their AI strategy. And I was like, yeah, you don't have the $10 million to dip the toe into the pond. That's not completion.
Even if
you lose it,
it's okay.
Right? To just foray into that is going to cost you 10. And I don't even know if you're going to get a result from that. Because if you actually go and Google what it took ChatGPT with OpenAI to get to where they were going, when ChatGPT was just available to everybody, every time somebody put in something to ChatGPT, it was a 20 cents for every query that was happening.
I think it's like over $1 million per day in just operating ChatGPT.
It is far exceeded that. And, you know, they just got an infusion of, you know, over $1 billion to just keep up with what they're doing, right? So again, think of dilution, think about all of the different things going on and all of that.
Alex,
right?
I'll give you an analogy. Just like you talk about best practices, I also talk about average. You know, the word average, I hate that word. Yeah. If you are in a room of 100 people, there are 50 of them that are 7 feet tall, and there are 50 of them that are 4 feet tall. What is the average height of the room?
Right.
The average does not represent the room at all. The same applies to when it comes to best practices.
Yeah.
People read articles in Forbes and Inc. magazine and internetretailer.com or whatever blog it is. And they go like, oh, XYZ said they got great results when they did this thing. Yeah, they're in the fashion industry. You sell personal care products.
Yeah.
How do you think that translates, right?
Yeah.
That best practices may be brilliant for the fashion industry. In your industry, it's irrelevant. You're going to lose money by doing it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's
well,
the
often,
thing.
Yeah, oftentimes that type of phrasing, when somebody says best practices, the reason it's such a red flag for me is that oftentimes that person is using a best practice as their ripcord for failure. Right? It's like, well, I did best practices. What else did you want me to do? Right? And
it's
if you're right. And if you're a smaller company, if you're trying to grow, you're trying to do those things, you can get away with a best practice statement in an S&P 100 and above, right? Because you can say, hey, look, I need an additional $500 million to push this thing. And it's like, okay, here you go, right? But in our world, you don't have that latitude. Right. And so if you come to me and say, hey, Alex, best practice in marketing is to do da 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 da, right? Then and nothing comes of it. And I'm just using it simply because, you know, you tend to work in more on the marketing space. You could come at me and say, well, we use best practices, you know, it just didn't work out. And now I'm out my $6.5 million. And it's like, I owe somebody $5 million for something that didn't work. What are you talking about? Right. And so you've got, you know, in terms of that question that you asked, is like, what if you're in a room of people guiding you or giving you feedback? It's like, you've got to be careful with what you are listening to, because somebody's going to say best practice. And you're like, yeah, I can't afford best practice. I can't afford the non-performance of the best practice. And I cannot afford the implementation of the best practice. So as it, as a, you know, again, I think one of the things that people who want to be an entrepreneur struggle with the most is at the end of the day, no matter what happens or anybody does or anybody says, there is only one person who is responsible for everything.
You.
And that's it. Like, there is no looking over the shoulder. What about? It's like, nope.
Oh, you. That's it.
It's you.
Period.
And if you can't handle that, if that is way too much for you, you've got to really rethink about what you're doing, because at the end of the day, they're going to come back at you and you will be the one who will have to sit there and answer the question. And that can be really hard. That can be very, very, you know, and if that's just, I am comfortable in that space. I'm okay with somebody sitting and pointing their finger at me and saying, you messed that up. And the one thing that I had to learn over the years is to be able to look at them and say, yeah, you're right. I goofed it. I really missed it. And own that component, get past it, rather than being defensive and trying to deflect it. Because the more you deflect, the more it just reveals how, you know, professionally immature
it's
you
more,
are.
It's more about your ego in that scenario than facts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, no, that's not mine because of this, because of that. It's like, yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, that brand is you.
So Alex, given your 20 years of this rich experience and prior to that too, what is your number one takeaway, like number $100,000 expert insight and advice for business owners who want to go the organic route?
I think that the don't lose sight of the end game, right? In, you're going to go through the trials and tribulations. You're going to go through the ups and downs. Know that you're going to have days that you are floating and days that you feel like you just got a ton of gravel poured on you. It's just going to happen. Know it. Know that at some point those things will happen. And it, and then apply the grit. You know, it's unrelenting persistence in the face of failure. You have to just will it to be there. And if the product or the service isn't mistimed, adapt. Leave your ego at the door. Don't sit there and don't be an entrepreneur or a business owner because you want to wear some title and walk into a room and be, you know, the important person. That is not what this is about. This is about taking something and either creating a world for yourself, independence for yourself, or wanting to see something come to fruition, and know that it will take a toll on you. It will take a toll on you. There is no way around it. And so eyes wide open, you know, go into it and know that you're the one who is responsible for it at the end of the day, no matter what you come up with. So those would be my offerings.
Alex, thank you for being on the show and sharing your journey with us.
Thank you for having the patience to listen to all of me. So,
by the way, my name means patience, by the way, Alex. So well, actually, you've exhibited it. Literally means patience.
So thank you so much.
Thank you. I mean, it was really kind of invaluable, and especially sharing the organic route. It is challenging. It's the road less traveled, but definitely I think companies can grow, businesses can grow in a much more consistent way over time, rather than this crash and burn type of a lot of growth that we see nowadays.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
So, and especially thank you to our amazing audience for tuning in. Stay curious, stay innovative, and join us again next week for more insights and inspiration from amazing guests like Alex. You'll have a lot more joining us. And that's a wrap for this week with Sabir. Until next time. Bye.